Okay, looks like we're going to start the technet. A little bit delayed. I was giving the guys who are doing the fox hunting a little bit more time to have a pure signal to search. Main purpose of the technet, you guys have heard lots of times, is education. We amateurs in the tri-state area get together and help educate each other. That's how all this hardware works. Transmission lines and antennas and transmitters and receivers and satellites. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. 2-meter FM ham radio, the one you're listening to right now, is just one of the 26 kinds. We're probably going to experience a little bit of jamming tonight. There is a disgruntled individual out there, a sad individual who I am guessing is a person with a disability, a person who is unemployed, a person who is living in his mother's house, is my guess. And he thinks he's being anonymous, and he thinks by being disruptive, he's going to get some kind of pleasure out of this. He can't really go to many of his friends and brag about it, but that's what he's doing. And to think he's getting pleasure out of it because he's not having fun in his life, and he hears these ham radio operators having fun in their life, that bothers him. And so by his disruption, he thinks he's finding a way of getting pleasure. It's not going to last very long, but he'll eventually be stopped, just a matter of time. So he's not going to stop us. He'll slow us down a little bit. But if you've got the perseverance, we'll have run the technet anyhow. The way a person signs into the technical net is to give John, KC2WGB, and me, K2RIW, give us your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. As I said before, there's a lot of brain power in the northern New York, northern New Jersey, southern New York State, and eastern Connecticut area, plus Long Island, and we try to tap into that. Not all the information you're going to hear is 100% accurate. We don't guarantee that. We try to make a sincere effort. We try to make a sincere effort that during the first hour, the person who signs in gets at least a brief answer. So you're not going to have to wait longer than an hour, it says here. At the end of that hour, John goes to the mailbag, which used to be called Mel's Corner. Now John's Corner, I'm going to call it. For the people who don't yet have a ham radio license, and they send either an email or a snail mail to John with their question in the process of them getting their license. After that, Paul, WS2N, will tell us the latest on what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing. And they've just launched a beautiful new satellite we'll be hearing about. After those hour and a half or so things that I just described, we then usually go into deeper subjects. If Glenn is available tonight, KC2QIQ, I'm going to have a bit of a discussion with him on the subject of magnetic circuits, if he happens to be available. I've also got to report to you some of the results of both the experiment I was doing with reference to salt water electrocution, because you probably have heard my theory. Let me drop. It's my theory that a significant number of the people who supposedly drowned during Superstorm Sandy really were electrocution. If your body is within salt water and that electrical outlet anywhere is touching that salt water in the vicinity of your house, you're in an awful lot of trouble. I've done some experiments that seem to be confirming that. Also, another set of experiments I've been doing is to find out whether or not the creator of the microwave oven, Percy Spencer, did he really do it by the way that's advertised, where he supposedly had a chocolate bar with peanuts in it in his pocket. He was doing some research work on a magnetron high-power microwave tube. This is for World War II electronics development for radar. And the candy bar melted in his pocket because of the microwave exposure is the story. And I've done a series of experiments that strongly suggest that that story is inaccurate. You'll hear some of those details. Those are some of the things we'll be discussing later on. So, people who do have a question or a comment for the TechNet tonight, let me drop for a second. I'm guessing there's a couple of human beings somewhere on planet Earth that are not right now not watching the Super Bowl game in New Orleans. There must be a couple of people who are ham radio enthusiasts, and football is not their whole raison d'etre, the whole reason for existence. There's got to be a couple. So they will let us know by signing in and tell us they got a question or a comment. Give me the call letters and name right now. K2RIW listening.
And to XM.
anyone else.
Well, if you can touch the basis of the electromagnetic wave, I really, really love your theory about the magnetic parts playing the major role. Wesley, NTX here.
QMB, no traffic. Have a good night, guys. I'm listening. I'm in my car.
Glad to hear that. Wes, we heard you, and glad to hear that, Barry. There was another person trying to check in while Wes was talking. Who was that other person? Give me your call letters and name right now.
W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe. Yes. He's uncle, yes.
Okay, I got Joe and somebody who said uncle. Who is the person who said uncle?
It's Bernie, K2 Monkey's uncle. Yes.
Okay, Bernie, we got you. Let's see, we got Joe, Bernie. Who else wants to check in? Give me your call letters and name right now.
A-U-C-M-Q, Neil,
yes. Okay, I think I heard Delta Foxtrot Quebec, Neil, with a Kilo Bravo 2. What was the prefix on that, Neil?
Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike, Quebec.
Okay, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike, Quebec, Neil. We got you. Anyone else?
Might have doubled WS2N, Paul, with this space report.
KC2, Stranger J,
no traffic.
Okay, no traffic. We got you. Paul, we got you. So far we've got the check-ins with real questions is Joe, Bernie, and Neil. Anyone else? Give me your call letters right now.
82, DTL, Bill, yes.
Okay, I heard Bill, Kilo Delta 2 blank. Give me the rest of that, Bill.
That's Kilo Delta 2 Delta Golf Lima.
Kilo Delta 2 Delta Golf Lima. We got you, Bill. Okay. Anyone else to check in? Give me a call letters and name right now.
This is Bill, KC2SYL. I believe you have the name of the other individual. It could be Bill, but I'm not sure. Person that checked in just before me. Once again, Bill, KC2SYL, with the question, yes.
Very fine, Bill. Okay, we got Bill number one, which is Delta Golf Lima. We got Bill number two, Sierra Yankee Lima. We got you all. Anyone else? Give me a call with his name right now.
M2, okay, and first name Matt, no questions.
Okay, Matt with no questions. Got more than enough to get started. Joe is the first guy. To be 2RYY. What's new with you, Joe? K2RYW in the TechNet.
Oh, not too much, Dick. Good evening to you. I have a question and a comment. Actually, a comment first and a question. So, can I do it in that order? The comments will be rather quick.
There's a small fee involved, but John will be mailing you a bill. Go right ahead, Joe.
Okay, the comment was about what I found. And this actually goes back several months to like last year when I worked at one particular radio shop, about what you can find with about checking with a bird watt meter, checking a mobile installation, and some of the results you can find that don't seem to jive correctly. All right? I'll tell you what I found. A particular case happened to be a mobile radio came in, and the mobile radio is running about, say, 25 watts. The complaint was that the customer wasn't hitting the repeater very well. All right, so the thing was stationary out in front of the shop. Just make a break here for it. And a measurement was made on the system, and it showed about 20 watts forward and about 3 to 4 watts reflected on the on the installation. And the guy's running a quarter wave antenna on the roof of the vehicle. I measured the signal level from inside the shop using a outside antenna fairly high on the tower at the particular location. And I got a reading, I'd say, like about minus 65 dBm when I listened to the input of the repeater of this particular mobile customer. Okay, follow that so far?
Roger, Dodger. Go ahead.
Okay. And I couldn't understand why this mobile wasn't hitting the repeater, like about, say, 10 miles away. It was 25 watts or so. It was, like, very noisy into the repeater. It really couldn't make it at all. Where I could take an HD inside the shop and hit the repeater, actually quite readable. So it's kind of puzzling. So I took a VOM, put a VOM across the cable when I took the antenna off the roof, and I measured about 300 to 400K of resistance, which apparently was moisture content or something in the antenna circuit. And this is enough to cause a serious degradation of the signal because I had one of the techs take the cable completely out of the vehicle and put a brand new cable in. Now, mind you, the vehicle did not change positions. It was physically parked at one spot, didn't change location at all. So I didn't have any kind of relative path change between that vehicle and my antenna I was receiving the signal on. After we got done with the same radio checking it the same way, the forward power apparently went up to about 23, 24 watts. The reflective power went down about less than a half a watt, and he showed an increase of almost 15 decibels on my spectrum analyzer as I was reading that particular mobile from the fixed location. What do you think about that?
I believe your readings, and I've seen something similar. You were doing it on either 2 meters or 450, I'm not sure which.
450.
Okay, 450, even more. And I was doing it on 432. I've seen those very similar characteristics. If the water in the cable is properly distributed so that it is, let's say, underneath the jacket, the water is roaming around in the braid, but it's not very much penetration of the polyethylene and therefore touching the center conductor. So you get very little water touching the center conductor. Therefore, your ohm meter doesn't show very much resistance. 300K, by the way, is an amount that should be alarming. A really good piece of cable on a good ohm meter should be many, many megohms. When you start getting down to numbers like 300K, you're starting to show water. And water, although it's not spending a whole lot of time throughout the length of the cable touching center conductor to shield, because the polyethylene is doing its job, still the water is present in the cable. Water is an extremely lossy substance at RF frequencies. That's the whole principle of operation of a microwave oven. The water molecule, let me drop. The water molecule is a polar molecule. One end of it is positive, the other end of it is negative. That's just the way the two hydrogens gather at one end and the oxygen at the other end is the way the molecule arranges itself. If I was designing a water molecule, I would have one hydrogen molecule at 12 o'clock, one at 6 o'clock, and the oxygen in the middle. That would be a nice symmetric molecule. Mother Nature didn't do it that way. She makes those two hydrogen molecules at one end with something like 110 degrees of difference between the two, as opposed to 180. Therefore, it is a polar molecule, and that does a whole lot of things with reference to solvency of water. Water is probably the most universal solvent. It'll dissolve a whole lot of things. But during a microwave exposure, that water molecule flips back and forth on each half cycle of the microwave signal and tries to follow that. And that has all kinds of effects. The bottom line is water is extremely absorptive. 90% of all the cooking that takes place in your microwave oven is because of the water content. So that water being a lossy material means that what you think is a coaxial cable. Let me drop. What you think is a coaxial cable is really a distributed attenuator. And so, although the water presence is making a little bit of difference in visual, that 2 or 3 watts that you saw reflected back, partially that was due to the water. However, the signal going up to the antenna, hitting the antenna, and whatever is trying to come back, is experiencing that insertion loss of the water. It's really as if you had put a couple of 1 dB attenuators distributed throughout that cable. And it can really knock down the signal something fierce. I have seen a couple of drops, 2 drops of water, inside of a type N connector at the top of the tower on 432 create 10 decibels of loss. Just 2 drops of water inside the connector. I've seen that. I've also tried to pour 700 watts of 432 energy in there saying I'm going to boil away the water. Bad move. Doesn't work that way. Ends up that you end up with the water as acting as an electrolyte between the center conductor and the outer material. You've got dissimilar metals. You end up making a white, pasty mess of slightly conductive powder in the middle of the antenna when you try to boil away the water. It doesn't work. So you're double confirming that water is a very lossy material distributed throughout a cable. It's a real problem. And if you're a serious VHF, UHF operator, you better do a darn good job of weatherproofing your connectors. Because even if, let me drop, even if you're using what you think is a low-loss foam-filled cable, and yes, they do have lower loss than the solid cables, I always make the flexible piece of cable at the top of the tower a piece of solid polyethylene cable, RG9 or RG214 is my favorite. For the flexible length, I will not use foam-filled flexible cable there because that nice black polyethylene jacket on the outside of your cable is a good weather seal. It is not a hermetic seal. Water vapor will slowly, over a couple of year period of time, migrate through that jacket, get into the cable, get into the foam, and can make a whole lot of loss, and I've experienced that. So keeping water out of your cable is a real good thing to do. As such, I would never use a foam-filled cable for any significant length outdoors. Hardline is the right way to go. And if you must use a flexible piece of cable, make sure it is made out of a dielectric material that cannot absorb water, like solid polyethylene or solid Teflon. Those are my recommendations. And you've got a beautiful example there that's confirming it, Joe. W2LYY, T2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good, very good. Very beautiful explanation there. And here's the question. I've heard you mention this before, and this is just, I'm just trying to understand what actually is happening here. You said that in a case of electricity flowing through a cable, like in a battery cable, between your battery and the starter motor of your vehicle, where it's flowing through a length of about 3 to 4 feet of cable, that it would take one electron several hours to go from one point to another point. Can you explain to me, I know it's kind of quite hard for me to understand, but just explain to me, maybe there is a group out here, of how you would actually prove that out in theory. There's got to be a way of proving that out and how you come up with that explanation. Back to you.
Yeah, this is one of my favorite puzzles, Joe, and the way I usually word it is very fictitious. I say there's a red electron coming out of that battery right now, and you're going to watch that red electron travel down that 3-foot piece of cable between the battery and the solenoid of the starter motor. On average, if your starter motor draws 200 amperes, and your starter motor, by the way, is really a 2-volt motor being fed 12 volts, so for a brief period of time, it can turn out tremendous amounts of power. But if you run that starter motor any more than about 20 seconds, you're going to be overheating it. You do that 2 or 3 times in a row because you've got a very difficult to start automobile, and there's a good chance you're going to burn up the windings of that starter motor. It's a very intermittent device. But if your starter motor could draw 200 amperes for a continuous period of time, it would take 4 hours for that red electron to get from the battery to the starter motor. What's really happening is that all of those electrons, there's a tremendous number of electrons in that copper cable. One extra valence electron is capable of moving around per copper molecule, but the total number of copper molecules in that cable is a really big number. I don't know the exact number, but if somebody told me it was 10 to the 25 power, I'd believe it. It's a really big number. All of those electrons in that cable are like marbles in a pipe. You push one marble into one end of the pipe and another marble pops out at the other end of the pipe, not the same marble. You can do a very simple calculation that will confirm this. To do a real physical measurement to confirm it is difficult, but let me drop. With a little bit of searching on the internet, you'll eventually find out how many copper molecules there are per gram of copper. And you can estimate how many grams of copper there are in that length of cable that goes from your battery to your starter motor. You can eventually figure out exactly how many electrons are there. If there are roughly 10 to the 18 electrons, the definition of 1 ampere is 1 coulomb of charge flows through one point in space in 1 second of time. That's the definition of an ampere. The charge of each number, each electron is something like 10 to the minus 19 coulombs. So 10 to the 19 coulombs, 10 to the 19 electrons flowing through one point on your piece of wire in 1 second is an ampere. You calculate the number of electrons that are in that piece of copper pipe, you'll soon find out that if Mother Nature would let you do it, she really insists on complete balance at all times. You take a few electrons out of the tail end of that copper cable, and she insists that you're going to put a few in at the front end in order to keep everything balanced. But if she would allow you to unbalance that system, you could disconnect the copper cable from the battery and drain those electrons out of that, just those free electrons out of that copper cable. You could drain 200 amperes worth of them for 4 solid hours with no connection from the battery, if Mother Nature would let you do that much imbalance.
she won't, but that's how many electrons are there. So you can confirm it for yourself, Joe, by finding out how many copper molecules are in that cable, knowing there's one extra electron for each one. You'll therefore know how many electrons are in the cable, how many marbles are in the pipe, and therefore you can then figure out how long it takes to drain all those marbles, and it's going to be on average 4 hours. I don't blame you for being skeptical of this. A very respected book in physics, let me drop this. It's a very respected book that I recommend everybody get a copy of. It costs about $28. It's a softback, it's a paperback book with a purple cover by Epstein. It's called Thinking Physics by Epstein. And each one of those pages is a simple stick diagram of a situation with a multiple choice question. And all the answers are there on the very next page. You look at those examples of physics, and you'll get an understanding of physics like you've never had before. The first thing that will happen when you start reading that book is you'll say, I've taken college physics. Why the hell didn't they use this as a secondary textbook? It does 10 times better job of teaching the subject and the way it is taught in our schools right now. So Epstein's book, Thinking Physics, that's just one of the 150 little examples that are in that book. This draining copper, electron, draining the electrons out of a copper piece of cable. To really make the measurement, as you can tell, there is no way that you can see the individual molecules. There's no way by far that you can see the electrons. And my example of the red electron coming out of the battery, of course that's crazy. There is no such thing as a red electron. So the real measurement is a series of steps of building the faith, of knowing how much charge there is per electron, knowing how many electrons there are per copper molecule, knowing how many copper molecules are there, knowing the definition of how many electrons makes an ampere, and so on. Step by step, you build up the argument, but it's not a direct measurement, I'm sorry to say, Joe. To B2RYY, K2LAW in the TechNet.
2BH1,
second. Jim recognized. Go ahead, Joe.
Explanation. That seems to open up the understanding a little bit more when you put it together piece by piece by piece. Thank you very much. Back to TechNet.
It's sad to say that a number of places in the world, you have to build it up step by step. It took us a long time to find out what does a molecule look like. You had a whole bunch of smart people like Rutherford and I can't think of all these guys' names right now. A whole bunch of, around the turn of the century, Heisenberg and Einstein. You get a whole bunch of people trying to figure out what does atoms look like. And you'd like to think that, you just build a bigger and bigger and bigger microscope with higher and higher power and greater light source, and you eventually get down and see the individual atoms and molecules. No way in hell. The wavelength of light that you and I use is thousands of times bigger. One single wavelength is thousands of times bigger than what one atom is. So no way in the world are you going to resolve an atom. I mean, say for instance you and I are using a microscope or a telescope or whatever, or your eye, and you're looking at an object. When you look at an object, the way you resolve the individual shape and size and everything else of an object is that the object must have a width of thousands of wavelengths in order for you to put together a picture of its color, its shape, its size. Thousands of wavelengths allow you to do resolution. And when you're trying to look at a molecule or an atom, you've got it exactly backwards. Not only is the object you're looking at not thousands of wavelengths wide, it is one thousandth of a wavelength wide. You're wrong by a million to one to be able to resolve it. You can't. What they finally did is by X-ray diffraction, the same thing when it comes to resolving what does the DNA molecule look like. By shooting X-rays at it and looking at the way the X-rays scatter, a very complicated pattern, the way they scatter against the wall and give you a picture, so to speak. But if you're smart enough and figure out...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
If you're smart enough and look at that very complicated picture of a whole bunch of dots with a very specific pattern, and you play it backwards in your mind. What must the arrangement of the original atoms and molecules have been to have given you an X-ray diffraction scattering pattern that gives you that pattern? And you can slowly figure it out. That's how Watson and Crick finally did it, by X-ray diffraction. Nobody has yet created a microscope
powerful enough to see the individual atoms and molecules of the DNA string. We got this beautiful example of what the DNA double helix looks like. Nobody has ever seen it. It's been reconstructed step by step from other experiments, as you can tell. There's a hell of a lot of things in the microscopic world, the atomic world, that are like that. Ain't easy. Okay, the next person on the list was, let's see,
Stan with a comment on this.
Okay, make a brief comment, Wes, go ahead.
Well, I have a problem with your statement, because we can see the atoms. And there is a number of links, since I am allowed only to go brief to it, which shows the way in which the atoms are being seen. And it's not new. Enter here.
Something called a tunneling electron microscope, where you have an extremely sharp needle that you wave over the surface of a substance, a supposedly flat surface, and by the way the electrons jump from the tip of your needle over to the substance, and you make the needle go up and down until you keep the electron flow constant by an indirect process of a kind of a raster scan, you do get a kind of a picture that looks like a contour map of the surface of an atom, of the surface of a material, and yes, you're looking at individual molecules as that reconstructed surface. So yes, a tunneling electron microscope will give you a kind of a picture of the surface. It's not really showing you the picture of the individual atom or molecule, but you can get sort of a picture out of that. And that's what I think Wes is referring to. Next person on the list was Bernie. K2 November Uniform, I think it is. K2LIW. Go ahead, Bernie.
You taking light checkers? This is K2MC.
Yes, we got you on the list, Mel. Not to worry. Go ahead, Bernie. K2 November Uniform, you got it.
It's Mark's uncle, and I just, on a quick break, do you copy me okay?
Yes, Bernie, we're copying you okay. Proceed with your question.
Okie dokie, my other ring is a 100-foot tower with a couple of Yagis. But in the meantime, I got my HD on my couch in my apartment, so I'm glad I'm out. This is more in the line of acoustics. I asked this question several weeks ago. During the hurricane, I think you were not on or you were delayed that evening. And I had asked John, KC2WGB, and he gave a speculation, and I wanted to by you. I can't get a sound meter to ever register zero. John suggested maybe it was internal noise. I don't know. I can't seem to figure that out. If I cover up the microphone, it doesn't seem to go away. That would suggest internal noise, but I don't know what's going on with that. I have one in the iPhone and another one, sound meter, you know, just an old-fashioned sound meter. And related to that question is very often there are high-pitched sounds depending on the electronics. Or even outside. Now, I'm just wondering if you know about this phenomenon. Is there something going on with sound waves, with high frequency sounds that are preventing sound meters from ever registering zero decibels? This is K2 Monkey's Uncle, Bayside, New York.
K2 Monkey's Uncle, K2RIW. Got to give you a warning, Bernie. When you're talking to us from your apartment in a comfortable place with your handy talkie, you are 50% noise, 50% audio. And we did have a couple of dropouts as you moved the handy-talkie around. So had you been using the 100-foot tower, we've heard you a lot better. Now, in the case of a sound meter that doesn't go to zero, I'm reasonably sure that if the sound meter is working correctly, the real answer is there is no zero sound. As you go to more and more sensitivity of detecting devices, there's always some residual sound, unless you very carefully construct some kind of a acoustic anechoic chamber by which you put the sensing microphone in it. The real world always has sound. Even though it may be below the threshold of your hearing, the real world always has sound. One of the crazy experiments you can do is get a real good set of earplugs put them into your ears, and put the earmuffs, the real good sound absorbing kind of earmuffs, outside so that you really cancel all the sound coming from the outside world into your ears. Let me drop. You do that and wait a few minutes until your hearing system comes up to its real sensitivity. Your hearing system is logarithmic and it's varying in sensitivity. You'll hear things at nighttime because it's quieter than you would ever hear during the daytime. Your hearing sensitivity increases, very similar to what your eyes do. You go outside on a really dark night, you have to wait 20 to 30 minutes for your eyes to come up to full sensitivity. Same thing with your hearing. But you put in those real good set of earphones, so to speak, and sit and wait, and all of a sudden you'll realize that all the time you can hear the blood flowing through your eardrums. You'll hear your heartbeat. You do a little bit of walking around the room. You will hear the pounding sound of your feet touching the floor, and the pounding sound goes through the bones into your ears. So the process of walking makes all kinds of sounds. Moving your muscles makes sounds. The heartbeat makes sounds. Your breathing makes sounds. All of that sound has always been there, but because it is being overcome by other sounds in your environment, you're not conscious of it. So I think my first step of understanding of why your sound meter doesn't go to zero is because the sound isn't zero. There's always some sound there, unless you very carefully put the microphone into some kind of a very well-constructed anechoic chamber, and that anechoic chamber, it itself is not perfect. Let me drop. Your acoustic anechoic chamber maybe cuts down the amount of environmental sound by 60 decibels, but it can't be perfect. This is on the assumption your electronics is perfect. And on the assumption you have a good front-end transistor of your audio amplifier. Every real transistor has a certain phenomenon called noise figure, so that even if you put zero signal into that transistor, because of the method by which it develops its gain, there's always going to be some excess noise coming out of the transistor generated within the transistor itself, unless you cryogenically cool the transistor. So there's electronic noise, there's some amount of electronic noise in your acoustic meter. There's ways you can find out how much. A certain amount of real noise is coming into your microphone. The microphone itself is making a little bit of extraneous noise, believe it or not. So the fact that it doesn't go to zero, it's going to take a number of extra experiments to find that one out, as I see it, Bernie. But as you do further investigate that, you may find that there's a way you can construct a real good anechoic chamber around that microphone, where you can now make its so-called zero setting a hell of a lot lower than the zero that you normally see. As you start doing that research, doing the web search, and doing those experiments, please come back and let us know what you find. I'm giving you a speculation that there's always noise there, and it's seeing it. If it's really working well, nothing is perfectly quiet. Nothing is perfectly dark. Nothing is perfectly noise-free. If you've got a sensitive enough radio telescope, it is always seeing some real radio noise, because the world is like that. Everything above absolute zero in temperature is making radio noise and making acoustic noise. That's a strong speculation on my part, as I see it, Bernie. K2, Monkey's Uncle, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I think I'm in a better spot here. I understand your answer. I would hope that the sound meter people would compensate for internal noise. I'm talking about on the quietest setting, not being able to get below about 25 decibels. I mean, I would understand a few decibels. I'm talking about 25 decibels in the quietest possible environment, still measuring about 25 decibels. So on a quick follow-up, do you know if there's any connection do you know anything about these high-pitched sounds? I don't think I have tinnitus. I don't know if anybody notices them. If I think I have good hearing and I hear the high-pitched sounds bouncing around all over the place frequently, I wonder if you have any comment on that. And also, after that, I just have a brief comment. I wanted to relay some nice information to the ham community. Back to you, Dick.
You think you've moved into a better position. And when you move into a better position where you hear the repeater well, that is not the position where the repeater hears you the best.
thought, but you're a few thousand wavelengths away from that repeater, and it all starts adding up. So there's a bunch of peaks and valleys in your room, and the peaks and valleys for best reception and the peaks and valleys for best transmission are not the same locations. They're not the same peaks and valleys. And you asked for, can the meter do internal compensation? You can't internally compensate random noise. If there was a simple DC offset somewhere in your electronics, yes, you can create, by way of a differential amplifier, you can create another DC voltage to compensate for a DC offset. But an alternating random noise signal, there is no compensation for that. You can force an absolute zero, but it's a phony absolute zero, if you know what I mean. If there's real noise there, you can't cancel the real noise, as I see it. Now, when it comes to high-frequency sounds that I think you said you're hearing, let me drop. If you're one of those lucky guys who has a real good set of ears that don't experience the normal aging process, let me give you an example of that. I was in the radio and television repair business when I was 16, 17 years of age. And because I, even though I had experienced some very loud sounds of the radio, of the model airplane engines that I had sometimes tuned up in my basement and really created some sound that was so loud that my ears would be ringing. I'm very lucky that I didn't damage my hearing in that process. But even with that as an experience, when I was 12 years old, loud sounds, by the time I'm 17 or 18 years of age, I'm repairing people's television sets in the town of Middle Island, Suffolk County, where I was living. I could walk into a house. As I walked through the front door, I could tell you exactly how many television sets were running and in which room they were in. I was hearing the 15 kilohertz horizontal sweep rate of the television sets made a very distinctive sound, and with the directionness of my hearing, I would sit in the living room, wave my head back and forth, and I'd say, you've got a television set in that bedroom, you've got a television set in that music room over there, and they're both running at this time. I could hear those sounds. Many people at a young age can hear sounds all the way up to at least 20 kilohertz. I was hearing 17 kilohertz like gangbusters. Well, by the time I hit roughly 30 years of age, all those television sets turned quiet. It isn't because they fixed the television sets. It's because as you age, the high-frequency notes are the first thing that falls off in your hearing. If you're one of those lucky guys that has young hearing where you can really go to 20 KC, and most people, let me pick a number, at age 40, probably can't hear anything beyond 8 kilohertz. Maybe only 6 or 8 kilohertz is all they can hear, because it starts falling off real fast as you age. Your dog can hear those high search signals, but you cannot, as a normal person. You're maybe...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So as I see it, Bernie, you're maybe one of those lucky guys. Tell me what sounds you hear and where you think they're coming from. K2 Mike Uniform, K2LAW.
Down a quick break, is this better?
Right now that sounds better. Please proceed.
Okay, sorry about that. I'm going to have a regular antenna hooked up here soon, I promise. This is getting a little annoying. High-pitched sounds, I know, I'm not sure if it's coming from the TV or if, I hope I'm not developing tinnitus. I don't know how to describe it. I'm guessing it's coming from electronics. I'm asking. I just want to let you guys know I met somebody not long ago who was a alleged in Texas. Very interesting. I had a little conversation. We talked about antennas. She did her master's thesis on log periodic dipole arrays and thought it was pretty funny that I was into it for fun. But here's the reason I mention it. I asked her if they taught her in PhDs and the UHF and all these super high universities. And their answer was yes. And I thought that was super cool. And I couldn't wait to tell you and everybody else out there that they're actually teaching engineers that ham.
Let's assume that I put 10 feet of cable
from each one of those dipoles, and then bring those three cables together to one great big triple junction, and it goes into the main transmission line going down on the shack. If I did that, the beautiful switching arrangement might not work the same, because that length of cable that I just gave in my example, 10 feet of cable between the dipoles, starts doing what's called impedance inverting. It's something you can see on a Smith chart. It's not simple, but what I'm getting at is the dipole that you're not feeding. I'm feeding 80 meter signal in there, and the 40 meter dipole is nearly an open circuit. But if that length of cable between the 40 meter dipole and the junction point just happens to be in the vicinity of a quarter wavelength long, a quarter wavelength of cable with an open circuit at one end, which is the 40 meter dipole, will become a short circuit at the junction, the other end, the way coaxial cable of a certain length does impedance modification complicates the thing. So in the case of your three dipoles, your three monopoles on VHF, UHF, and 6 meters, because they're not really in one spot, you have three pieces of cable coming to a junction. If you carefully choose the right length of cable, you can make it work. But just to randomly do it and pray that it's going to work like a charm, you could run into a little bit of a problem. Let me drop for a second. By the way, it's not going to explode. Nothing bad is going to happen if you just randomly chose three lengths of cable between the three antennas and brought them together. Just that there's a chance it won't work the way you want it to, because the length of cable from the individual antennas to the junction point is not zero. The fan dipole plus three lengths of cable are zero, so to speak, to the common junction point. In your case, they won't be zero. You are going to get some impedance modification, and life becomes a little more complicated. With proper design techniques, know that you definitely can choose the right length of cable to each of your three antennas coming to the junction point. You can make it work. I'm just saying that to just jump at it the way you did with a fan dipole could give you a little bit more complicated problem. Just letting you know where the minefield is, Neil. KD2, Charlie Mike, Quebec, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Where can I find the information to figure out the right length of cable to use?
Make believe, Neil, that I really want to know how to do brain surgery. But I only have an hour left. And I ask you, hey, Neil, what book do I go to? What website do I go to that's going to teach me how to do brain surgery in an hour? Obviously, there is no answer. You're now getting into one of the more complicated areas of RF engineering. The right way to do it is by way of a vector network analyzer. You find out what each of your antennas look like on the wrong frequency. Your 2 meter antenna, you find out what it looks like, what is its exact impedance on 6 meters and on 450, for instance. You do that on each of the three antennas. If you know the exact impedance of each of your antennas on the wrong frequency, and then once you know how to do stub cancellation techniques on coaxial cable, which is one of the things taught, and usually the senior year of electrical engineering school, where they teach you how to use a Smith chart, or how to do impedance matching. There's a definite way of doing it. The website by Berkeley, if you Google the word Berkeley and impedance matching, Berkeley College, or just Berkeley and impedance matching, you'll get a beautiful program. Let me drop. You'll get a website with a beautiful program where if you know the impedance of the load, and you know what impedance you want it to match to of your transmitter. Most likely your transmitter is 50 ohms and 0 ohms reactance. But maybe your transmitter is a little bit different. 49 ohms and 10 ohms of reactance. If you know the impedance of the transmitter and you know the impedance of the load, that Berkeley website will tell you exactly. It gives you 16 separate answers with all the numbers and 16 diagrams. And you choose the one that you like the most. L networks, LC networks, CL networks, Pi networks, T networks, L Pi, LT, and so on. It gives you 16 separate answers in 1 second if you give it the raw data and press go. But in your case, the raw data is going to be a little bit more complicated. because I know darn well the manufacturer of each of those antennas will not tell you what the impedance of the antenna is on the wrong frequency. You're going to have to find that out by way of a real measurement. I didn't say it's easy. Just know that it's possible. And if you keep asking the question of the right people who can help you out, there is an answer there. Just that the exact answer is not easy. It's a little bit like learning brain surgery, if you know what I mean. It's a lot of steps involved. I know I didn't exactly answer your question, but at least I told you what's involved, Nick. KD2, Charlie Mike Quebec, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Thanks, Nick. I really appreciate the information. If you have time, I have one or two, hopefully, simple questions.
To be fair, Nick, we really have a list of people. I should go through that whole list first, because our promise is that we try to give everybody at least a brief answer during the first hour. So I know you're on the list with an additional question. If you can hang around a little bit longer, we'll get to you. Let's see now. The fourth guy on the list was Delta Golf Lima. Kilo Delta 2. Bill number one. Kilo Delta 2, Delta Golf Lima. Go right ahead, Bill. KQRIW in the TechNet.
One thing that I've noticed is that if you increase the number of woods in the antenna, the radiation goes up by a square. And I'm wondering why I don't see any commercial or homebrew antennas made with at least two or three woods. That's just my question. Thank you.
Okay, there's a little bit of noise on that one, Bill number one. I know you're talking about something square, something to do with antennas. Your audio is a little bit too low. You got to give us more audio and give us more about what is the question. Something about antennas being square and why do they do it that way. So repeat your question, Bill number one. Kilo Delta 2, Delta Golf Lima, K2RIW in the TechNet.
My question is, with the magnetic loop antenna, if the radiation resistance goes up as a square to the number of loops, why do many commercial and homebrew antennas only use one loop?
Okay. In the case of the old-fashioned AM radios that are a great big wooden cabinet that we used to buy right after World War II. In those days, the magnetic loop antenna consisted of about 20 or 30 turns because they were operating at a very low frequency, roughly your one megacycle, as low as half a megacycle on the low end of the dial, and they're trying to squeeze it into a good size cabinet, and they hadn't yet invented the ferrite loop stick type of antenna. So with an ordinary low-frequency antenna, you have to use multiple turns in order to hit resonance. Every good receiving antenna, every good transmitting antenna must first be resonated at the operating frequency, and then it can radiate. There's a whole bunch of complicated reasons why. So when you're getting up to a number like 40 meters, 20 meters, 10 meters, one single loop is easy to resonate. If I was building an antenna for 100 kilohertz reception, and every so often over there in Scandinavia, they do turn on this Stephenson, I think it's called, transmitter. It's a megawatt transmitter that runs at roughly 100 kilohertz that was used in the early days, and for historic reasons, they turn it on periodically. And you can build a receiver without too much difficulty. Let me drop. You can build a receiver that will listen to that broadcast, and for historic reasons it's fun, but when you build that receiving antenna, with rare exception, you're going to use a whole lot of individual turns in order for the antenna to resonate at 100 kc. So the multiple turns are only to hit resonance within a reasonable size package, and because you've made the antenna smaller in diameter for whatever reason, you can bring it back into resonance by using more turns, and yes, the laws of inductance are such that the inductance of a coil, if it's arranged correctly, a
solenoid-like coil, the inductance goes up as a function of turns squared if and only if all the magnetic field from one turn links all the other turns. So if all your turns are tightly coupled, inductance goes up square law. And as the inductance, you're trying to resonate with a capacitor, so therefore it doesn't take very many turns before you've got enough inductance to resonate it. So the real reason is resonance at that frequency within that size of antenna. Wonder if that makes a little more sense, Bill number one. Kilo Delta 2, Delta Golf Lima, wait for the four beeps, K2RIW in the TechNet. If I was building a dipole on 80 meters,
and it was full length. It'd be 132 feet long, probably made out of 14-gauge wire, and if I decided to feed it in the center, I don't have to, it'd be an egg insulator in the center, it'd be 67 feet of wire on each side, and I would feed it with something like a 50 or 70 ohm coax cable with some kind of a balancing device. You could, if you want to, take that 132 feet dipole on 80 meters, squeeze it down to, let me pick a number, 30 feet of length instead of 132 feet of length. I'm taking out 100 feet of the wire. I've removed it. If I've got a high enough quality antenna tuner right at the center of that antenna, an impedance matching network, so I re-resonate that antenna that's now only 32 feet long at 80 meters, I would lose only half a dB. I would get full performance out of the antenna. That's the infinitesimal dipole. You can read about it in the appropriate chapter of Krauss's book on antennas. Of course it doesn't make sense. When you make the antenna small like that, you think you're going to get a smaller capture area. You think you're going to get a lot of loss in the antenna. Not at all. You will get the exact same amount of gain, except for half a dB of loss, because the antenna pattern, the dipole pattern, becomes a little bit fatter. The Q of the antenna goes sky high when you do that. Instead of it being an antenna that's half a megacycle wide, it will be 30 kc wide. You pure as wide 30 kc, and you've got to return the daylight out of that impedance matching network. That's a high Q antenna. That's a fancy way of saying that the signal is going to bounce back and forth a lot more times than the antenna before it gets radiated. But at the resonant frequency, it will radiate. It will have full area on reception, opposite of common sense. So, if you can make a full halfway dipole as small as you like, with the...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
With the right kind of impedance matching network, you make the dipole as short as you want. With the right impedance matching network, it will work like charm. You can see, going small, you can still get full performance. Going long, you can make it as long as you like. Again, in order to get efficient radiation, you have to resonate. Hard to believe, but every antenna, we all want to believe that the signal comes out of the transmitter, goes down the transmission line, hops onto the antenna, and then just jumps into space. We want to believe that. That's not the way it works. Radiation is hard. That signal, 95% of the signal, after it travels down the length of the wire of your dipole, for instance, 95% of it is left over at the end, and it reflects back. That signal is going to bounce back and forth on that antenna roughly 20 times before it gets radiated into space. We resonate the antenna. That's a fancy way of saying we make sure that all of those bounces stay in phase with each other, stay co-phase, you see what I mean. They all support each other. That's what resonance means. And I'm talking about electronic resonance. Even though the antenna may be too long or too short, electronically you can bring it back into resonance. And when you do that, your LC network that you add to the antenna makes the total length of time the signal bounces back and forth, all of those individual steps stay in step with each other. That's what resonance means. Once you've got the resonance, then all of those individual bounces, the current of them builds up to a higher current. That's what the Q of the antenna means. If the antenna has a Q of 10, that means the current within the antenna gets 10 times higher than the current that you launched from the transmission line. Let me drop. And the current being 10 times higher means there's 10 times more magnetic field. Therefore, the magnetic field is what really does the radiating, and the signal radiates efficiently. Yes, you can take any old piece of wire that's the wrong length, and you can still radiate, but it'll be a very inefficient radiation. It's what the electromagnetic compatibility guy will say, hey, you've got a leaky signal. You can pour all of your power into your antenna dummy load, and the guy that's a block away is still going to hear you. It's a very inefficient transmitter, but you're still transmitting. But to transmit efficiently, where you want 90% of the energy going into the antenna to really go into space, you will resonate the antenna. So your long wire, how you feed it, there's a zillion different ways you can feed it, but the long wire usually is fed from one end, and some kind of a pretty broad range antenna tuner is required to do it correctly. I don't know whether or not we're going to be able to hear you on 2 meters. I'm now using another frequency to get into the repeater right now. So I'm going to turn it back to you, Bill, and see if we can hear you. And maybe I'll hear you on the input. Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Yankee Lima to take it. K2IW on the tech net.